Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
I just wanted to take a minute at the start of the presentation to talk very, very briefly about foster care. There is a huge, huge need for foster parents, committed foster parents. So if this is something that you are discerning or it's on your heart, just come up, talk to me afterwards. I'd love to share. I've seen the good, the bad, the ugly of it, and be happy to help you in your discernment process with that. So I'll get off my soapbox now, get on to the presentation, and start off again by thanking the organizers. This has been a really thought-provoking conference, and then you have to listen to me talk. So my presentation is going to differ in both form and substance from some of the previous presentations. Sorry that the puns are not an accident of the presentation. But I want to start out by just kind of tempering your expectations. So when Father Ambrose approached me about this, and he said, you can be as philosophical as you like, I had this pit in my stomach because this is about as philosophical as I get here. You know, so I want to set your expectations that I have essentially no formal training in philosophy. So I'm going to try to steer clear of that concept or a lot of those principles today. The other thing that makes it a little bit difficult is I am not an organismal biologist, right? So I stop thinking of things bigger than a cell. So like Simba and Rafiki here, I don't think about things that big, at least in a biological perspective. So why am I here and what do I actually think about? So my formal training, I'm a biochemist, right? So I spend a lot of time thinking about molecular organization and self-replication that really underpins life, and really this interplay between when chemistry becomes life and how these molecules will interact with light. Now, my research can also be kind of classified as I touch on biophysics, I also touch on cell biology, which means I have the distinct opportunity today of offending people in four different fields. So I will be a little bit fast and loose with some of my terminology today. So please be aware of that and have some mercy with that, because my goal is to try to illuminate a lot of the biological principles that underlie the interaction of light with biological molecules. So I want to start out by giving you kind of this sense of scale, right? So with the physics, we covered something like 50, 60 orders of magnitude of scale yesterday. I'm a lot more narrow in what I look at, right? So I tend to think of things over 7 orders of magnitude. So again, if I don't think of things bigger than a cell, the standard cell, like, you know, our typical cell excluding neurons, which can be really extended, you know, kind of the biggest example of that would be a frog egg, which is about 1 millimeter in diameter. And the standard, you know, animal cell is somewhere on the order of, you know, 10 to 100 microns or micrometers. And a lot of the stuff that I think about, you know, bacteria or single cell, or sorry, mitochondria and organelles are more like 1 micrometer. And then we also do structural biologies, right? So we're trying to see the individual atoms that make up some of these macromolecules. And this is much more on the order of 1 nanometer if we want to see the individual bonds, right? We're at tenths of nanometers. And where does visible light fall in? Well, as a rough approximation, visible light is somewhere around the order of 500 nanometers in length. So I just, again, wanted to kind of set the sense of scale for what I'm going to be talking about today. Now, the other thing, and you saw this several times in the presentations the other day, is I'm not going to confine my discussion of light to visible light because, you know, it's all part of the electromagnetic radiation spectrum. But again, thinking about the order of things that, at least for how I think of biology, right, we're going to be looking at stuff kind of within the range of this red box, right? Somewhere between visible light all the way down to X-rays, because the wavelength of an X-ray is roughly the size of an atom. So kind of setting the stage with that, what am I actually going to talk about today? Well, I'm going to try to give a molecular perspective on light in biology. And there's going to be 3 parts to my presentation. So the first part of my presentation, I'm going to focus on energy production. and photosynthesis, and because I think this is something we all have experience with. It's somewhat intuitive to us. But I'm going to raise the question of, is light actually required for life? Again, trying to attempt some approach to causality here. So in the second part of my presentation, I'm going to talk about the role of light in generating genetic diversity and evolution. And then finally, I'll end with kind of a grab bag of different molecules that we understand that are involved in absorbing light or emitting light in some way. And because I'm an experimental biologist, I spend my time, you know, trying to design experiments that can rigorously test different hypotheses. I'm going to show you how at least someone like me would think about a lot of these tools or these different proteins and molecules as research tools. So with this, and thinking back to the fact that I touch on multiple different fields and there's different expertise here, this was a kind of tough talk to put together in terms of how to explain things. So with that, to kind of touch on these topics, I'm going to need to introduce the basics of thermodynamics, metabolism, and the central dogma of biology. So if you're familiar with that, be patient and understand that my goal here is to be understood. And if this is new, I hope I got the level of depth right, but you also might want to buckle up because I am going to go through a lot of these concepts pretty fast. So the first part of the presentation, right, I want to get at the question of, is light the ultimate source of energy for life on Earth? And I think early on in grade school, we kind of learn about this, a very simple diagram, right? The sun provides energy for the plants to do photosynthesis. Plants produce oxygen, which we need to live, and they also produce organic compounds, which we then eat. We being heterotrophs, or animals or different organisms that need to get carbon and or energy from plants, right? So we can't produce it on our own. We then consume this, and we generate carbon dioxide, and it's the circle of life. So to get at this, I want to start out by kind of digging into the concept of energy. Now, I think we understand energy, like for a multicellular organism like myself, if I'm moving around, I'm walking, I'm talking, I'm doing work, right, that's obvious, that's energy. But what about a stationary cell that we don't visibly see moving? Well, it still needs energy, right, because it's building macromolecules, it's doing work in that way, but it's also organized. And I highlight this not because it's comprehensive, but more so just because it's one of the less intuitive concepts of the need for energy, right? Organization takes energy. And as you know, a parent with three young kids, you can tell that it takes a lot of energy to go from this high entropy to this low entropy state, right? From disorganized to organized. And I would say this is a very unfavorable reaction to have take place, right? But the same thing takes place within the cell. The cell is highly, highly organized, right? We have, and this is a cartoon form, right? We have the orange protein going to the orange membrane and the blue protein going to the blue membrane. And this is something that I actually think about a great deal in my lab, is how does this organization take place? What are the energetic requirements for this? And getting back to the concept of the sun being a source of energy, like I don't have a solar panel on my head to keep things organized, right? How does this energy transduction actually take place? Well, if I want my kids to clean the room, I might couple that unfavorable reaction to something that is favorable, right? And that's how you get the reaction to go forward. Well, the same trick applies in biology, is we will couple a chemical reaction that is thermodynamically favorable to something that is thermodynamically unfavorable. Now, instead of donuts, what the cell tends to use is this molecule called ATP, or adenosine triphosphate. So this is adenosine, and then we have 1, 2, and 3 phosphates. And the hydrolysis of this phosphoanhydride bond here is actually thermodynamically very favorable. So you can use the energy from hydrolyzing this bond to turn ATP into adenosine diphosphate, or ADP, and you can couple that to drive an unfavorable reaction forward. So that's kind of the very basic concept of energy production. So that raises the question of, well, how do we make ATP in the first place? So with this, I want to kind of relate metabolism, at least in heterotrophs like you and me, to combustion, right? So if we want to get some work done, if we want to drive like a steam engine forward, right, we got to do a combustion reaction. So we're going to take an organic compound, wood, combine it with oxygen, and then we will get energy out in the form of heat and light, and we will get byproducts of carbon dioxide and water. Well, the same thing is happening in all of our cells, right? So we take some type of organic compound. This morning, I actually chose a banana. We combine it with oxygen. We get the byproducts of carbon dioxide and water, which we exhale, right? But instead of solely getting heat and light, right, we're able to capture it in the useful form of ATP. And the question is, how do we actually do this at the cellular level? So in a combustion reaction, right, or I guess in chemistry, we like to use these the concept of a reaction coordinate diagram. So with this, on the x-axis, we have this kind of nebulous concept of how far forward or how the reaction is proceeding, the reaction coordinate. And on the y-axis, we have the free energy of the reagents or of the reactants and products, right? So higher means it has more energy, lower here means less energy. So if you go from high to low energy, that means you're releasing energy in the process. What I want to emphasize here is two things. One, there's a large activation energy required, right? So if we think of this combustion reaction, how do you start it? Well, you need a lighter or you need a match. Well, that's not really good to have inside your stomach or inside your cells, right? That's not really compatible with life. The second thing is we're releasing all the energy fairly quickly in one large step. So in biology, what happens is instead of doing it in one large step, we try to do it in a lot of little steps. So many little steps. With each step, we're capturing some amount of energy. And the nice thing is it has a much lower activation energy, so it's going to be compatible with life. But the other thing is it's a controlled release so that we can generate ATP in the process. So that looks great in this kind of abstract diagram. How does that actually work in life? So with that, I want to use the analogy of a hydroelectric dam. So essentially the way, you know, a hydroelectric dam works is we have water stored in a reservoir, and it flows downhill, releases energy, or turns potential energy into kinetic energy, turns a turbine, and then that generates electricity. We're essentially doing the same thing in our cells, except instead of having water flow downhill, what we have are protons flowing down an electrochemical gradient, right? So what we're doing is we're organizing protons on one side of the membrane. We're generating a concentration gradient where we have lots and lots of protons being neatly and nicely organized on one side of the membrane, and then we're letting it through the FOF1 ATPase, which actually has a really, really good analogy for a turbine in a hydroelectric dam, because this thing actually spins as the protons flow through it, and it generates ATP in the process. And that is a very, very simplistic definition of how ATP, the majority of ATP, is generated within mitochondria, within our cells. And more or less, the same thing is happening within chloroplasts during photosynthesis, except instead of generating the proton gradient by a combustion-type reaction, we're actually using light to generate that proton gradient. And I know Keith is going to talk in much more detail about photosynthesis, so I'm going to give a very, very brief overview to kind of highlight some of the chemistry with this, right? So the idea with it is that we have these chlorophylls or these different photopigments that are able to absorb different photons of light and become excited. And what happens here is, you know, plants have photosystems, generally speaking, photosystem 2 and photosystem 1. And when light is absorbed by the chlorophyll molecule, it's going to excite an electron. And then that electron is going to be passed down and generate a proton gradient. And again, I'm not going to go into many of the details because I think Keith is covering this. But what I want to highlight here is when this electron gets excited, it essentially leaves a hole in photosystem 2. Right, it's lacking an electron, because if you follow this path, the electron goes from here all the way, ends up being transferred to form NADPH. So if we want this to be a cyclic type reaction, we need to replace that electron that was excited. Well, where does that electron come from? It comes from water, right? So we're extracting an electron from water, and we're turning water into oxygen in this process. So that's how plants essentially generate molecular oxygen as part of the photosynthetic reaction, right? So this seems to fit, right? Everything we learned in elementary school, plants get energy from the sun, they are able to generate organic products, they generate oxygen, you and I eat it, we generate our proton gradient, make ATP, things seem to work out well. And then when I teach, I like to show students this diagram, where we're categorizing living things based on two of the more fundamental requirements, right? We need energy, and we ultimately get our energy from either light, which are phototrophs, or we get it from chemical sources, like chemotrophs, right? So I went through plants, like trees, corn, all this stuff that we see. So those are phototrophs, right? And then I talked about things like you and me, where we are chemotrophs, and we break down organic compounds. And generally speaking, we use oxygen. There are also ways to generate energy by breaking down organic compounds without utilizing oxygen, which is really good for making beer. But I want to highlight some of the other types of ways to produce energy and also get your carbon source. So there's a way to do photosynthesis where you don't generate oxygen. So I want to try to take what I showed you at the beginning of this presentation and then kind of take a step back and generalize it a little bit more. So I'm going to talk about anoxygenic photosynthesis. So this is where, you know, I told you that the purpose of water in photosynthesis is to donate this electron, right, to fill that electron hole in photosystem II. Well, why do we need to use water to donate that electron? Can we just use some other chemical compound? The answer is yes, right? So, you know, the general form of photosynthesis, right? We have carbon dioxide, water, we have light energy coming in, and we produce glucose or sugar and oxygen. But we can generalize this to where we have carbon dioxide and then just some other electron donor. And that could be it could be hydrogen, it could be iron-containing compounds, it could be sulfur-containing compounds. And if we look kind of at the evolutionary history of Earth, this anoxygenic photosynthesis is actually preceded oxygenic photosynthesis, right? When we look at the Earth's early atmosphere, and again, this is kind of pushing the edge of my understanding of biology, because it's kind of far removed from my research, but I understand the chemistry here, right? The early Earth's atmosphere was thought to be a highly reducing environment. So it was very compatible with anoxygenic photosynthesis. And then, you know, somewhere around 2.5 billion years ago, we had something called the Great Oxygenation Event, where oxygenic photosynthesis started taking place in mass and made the Earth's atmosphere an oxidizing environment, which actually was really, really bad for life on Earth. It's actually thought to have caused probably the greatest mass extinction in the history of the planet, because oxygen screwed up all the chemistry of all the organisms that were alive at that point. But what I want to focus on here is, what about this period, about 4 billion years ago, before there was even anoxygenic photosynthesis? And if we go back to this diagram here, I want to focus right here on these organisms called chemoautotrophs. So what does that mean? Well, they get their chemical or their energy from a chemical source, right? So they're not getting it from the sun, but they get their carbon from carbon dioxide. So they're able to turn carbon into organic matter. So they're not eating anything, right? They're not eating plants. So let's go back to this combustion reaction and try to generalize it even more. So again, what's happening in this combustion reaction? Well, in chemistry and biochemistry, we would say it's a redox reaction or an oxidation reduction reaction, right? So what's happening, we have this carbon-based organic compound, and the carbon is being oxidized to carbon dioxide, right? So it's losing electrons to form carbon dioxide, whereas the oxygen is being reduced. It's gaining electrons and going to form water. So if we take it at this generalization, do we need to oxidize carbon, or can we oxidize some other chemical compound to generate the energy we need for life? And the answer for that is yes. And there's actually a lot of different types of redox reactions. And this class of category of organisms are called chemolithotrophs. right? So they're able to do oxidation of a number of different things, like iron, or they can do ammonia, or sulfur, or hydrogen, or different phosphates, right? So there's a lot of different types of chemistry that are compatible with energy production that can actually lead to life. And yeah, I know you might be thinking, like, this is some kind of a one-off thing that only occurs in the special environments of, you know, geothermal vents where it's, you know, super high pressure and temperature and high concentration of these compounds. And that's definitely true. There are situations to that, and that is, at least in my understanding, how some of the first forms of life were, or the environments that were compatible with the first forms of life. But we also see a lot of other examples of this, right? So one example we see are these banded iron formations, right? Where we have this insoluble iron 3, which is a byproduct of chemolithotroph metabolism. And this is actually one of the major sources of iron ore in the world, right? So this is not like a one-off. This is actually something that's really highly prevalent. And then something also that we're very familiar with, nitrifying bacteria, like we see that are associated with soybeans and can, you know, actually reduce the need for fertilizer, are also doing this type of chemistry that doesn't, strictly speaking, require carbon or light as an energy source. So the point of this is really just, again, to think about this idea of the sun as a potential cause for energy. And I'm not going to have a strong conclusion with it other than to say that, you know, if we look at kind of the fundamental principles of what we need for life, any discussion of light as a cause of energy, we have to take into account chemolithotrophs because they seem to be very prevalent and, in the at least my understanding of the evolutionary history of Earth, vitally important for the evolution of life. So with that, I'm going to move on to the second topic I'm going to cover, which is light as a source of genetic diversity. So I'm going to start this discussion with a very, you know, classical example of the benefits of genetic diversity and evolution, right? So we're going to look at kind of this textbook example of the peppered moth. So the peppered moth is, you know, this moth that can exist. We would say it has two allelic variants, and that can be either black pigmentation or white pigmentation. And they just exist within the population. And depending on the environment, it could be a competitive advantage. So each one of these pictures here has a white and a black moth on it. Now, if I'm a predator that eats moths, I'm going to go after the white moth on the black tree and the black moth on the white tree, because it's really hard for me to see these other moths that are much better camouflaged, much better adapted to their environment. But what happens if the environment changes? And this is actually a really cool case study that happened within relatively recent biological history, where the Industrial Revolution in England led to the production of, you know, or the byproduct of so much soot that it actually changed the coloration of a lot of the trees that these moths live on. And there was a significant shift in the proportion of the population of dark-colored moths because they were much better camouflaged on the soot-covered trees than the white-colored moths. So that's just a very quick, recent example of how genetic diversity can provide an advantage in a different environment. What I want to focus on today is how this genetic diversity can actually arise at the molecular and chemical level. So with that, I want to go over the central dogma of molecular biology. And there's always exceptions in biology, but generally speaking, the very simple way to think of it is we have DNA that makes RNA, that makes protein, right? And I think we are more or less familiar with the concept that DNA is what stores a lot of the genetic information. And then I'd like to be kind of quantitative with this, but, you know, a human being, roughly speaking, we have 20,000 annotated traditional genes. Again, many exceptions, but that's a first pass approximation. The DNA is in the nucleus, and then we need this molecule called RNA, which then goes between the nucleus and the ribosome, which produces the proteins. As a protein biochemist, I tend to think that proteins are the best molecule because they do all the work. Might have a slight bias there, but the proteins, just to give you an idea, that they're polymers composed of 20 different building blocks. Those building blocks are called amino acids. And then the polymers can be dramatically different, right? So they can be incredibly short, less than 20 amino acids, or some of the longest ones in humans, especially this protein titin, can be over 27,000 amino acids long, but built out of these same 20 building blocks, and the building blocks have different chemical properties. So I'm going to try to go through very briefly how a change in the DNA can affect or lead to a change in the protein structure, and how that can ultimately lead to a change in the interaction with the environment. So the concept of DNA, I think most people are familiar with the idea that it forms a double helix, right? So we have two strands that run in opposite directions. So we say they're anti-parallel. So one's going this way, the other's going this way. And it kind of looks like a ladder, with the steps of the ladder being composed of four different bases. And we think of it as A, T, G, and C. And there's base pairing rules, right? So A always pairs with T, and G always pairs with C. So this is very convenient for replication, right? Because if we want to divide our DNA, replicate it, we just simply peel apart the two strands, and then we have a template for the other strand, right? Because if we know the sequence on one strand, we know the sequence of the other because of these base pairing rules. And again, just to give you a sense of scale, humans, generally speaking, we have about 3 billion base pairs, again, encoding these 20,000 different genes. So how do we actually go from these four different bases to the 20 amino acids that make up a protein? Well, we get into the concept of something called a codon, right? So an amino acid is encoded by three consecutive bases called a codon, right? So you might have GCU, and sorry, I skipped over this. When you go to RNA, U is the same thing as T. So just you can interchange U and T, and it means the same thing, at least for what I'm discussing today. So three consecutive bases, that tells you what amino acid. So if you do the math, right, 4 to the 3rd is 64. So we have 64 different potential combinations of those three bases to encode the 20 amino acids. And this would be something called a codon table. So with this codon table, if you study it, we can actually see a lot of really interesting things. But I want to spend some time here because this tells us how a change in the DNA in the base actually goes and generates a change in the protein, which, you know, more or less does the work in a cell. So not all mutations are created equal. So if we look here, right, if we go from UUA to UUG, they both encode for leucine. Right, so we change the DNA, and actually at the protein level, nothing happens. So we would call this a silent mutation. But there's other changes where we change one base out of the 3 billion, and really, really bad things happen. So one of the proteins that I study in my lab is this protein called ubiquilin, and you change one amino acid, and you will get Lou Gehrig's disease. You will get ALS by changing one amino acid. And if you look at the codon table, that means you change one base out of 3 billion. You go from AUG to AGG. And my lab uses a number of different techniques, including structural biology, where we think we have an idea where we basically methionine's this really greasy hydrophobic amino acid. You change it to arginine, which has a big positive charge there, and all of a sudden, this purple thing doesn't bind. And we think that is actually one of the underlying bases for disease. But taking a step back, it's fascinating how you change one base out of 3 billion and you can end up getting disease. Now, there's lots of other types of mutations. Those I just went through were point mutations. One of the big things that some of you might be thinking is, well, if we're just kind of reading, you know, three bases at a time, what sets the reading frame? Or what happens if the reading frame gets changed? And that's when really bad things happen. This is called a frame shift mutation. So this is an example of where you read your three bases, move over, read three more bases, move over, read three more bases. Well, if you delete one base, now everything is shifted and the entire sequence of the protein is changed, which can be catastrophic for the entire protein. So those are just some of the examples of the types of mutations that can occur. There's many other types, but I think this was at least intuitively a little easier to understand and tie back to the actual DNA sequence. But then this begs the question of, what's the source of these mutations? And this is actually where I want to get to. So one of the thought experiments I'd like to have my students do is to go through the fidelity of DNA replication, right? So again, I've kind of thrown out this number that humans have roughly 3 billion base pairs of our DNA in each and every cell. And our enzyme that is able to replicate it whenever we need to divide our cells is really, really good. An error rate of, you know, 1 in a billion, which is awesome. Like most companies, Six Sigma couldn't even touch this, right? But there's a problem here in that the error rate is still higher than the number of bases we have, which means every time we replicate our DNA, we're going to pick up on average 3 mutations. And then take into account that the average, you know, adult male has somewhere around 3 times 10 to the 13th cells, and then things get a lot messier in terms of the heterogeneity of the DNA that we are actually composed of. Now, there's other sources of genetic mutation or genetic diversity I'm not really going to touch on other than mention like chromosome recombination during sexual reproduction. There's mobile genetic elements, so these quote-unquote jumping genes, which is actually thought to be the source of the color change in the peppered moths that I used at the beginning of this section of my presentation. I think we're all very familiar, at least intuitively, with environmental toxins or carcinogens, where it seems to be on everything, including like all the food we eat. It's warning may cause cancer. That's a major source. But what I want to talk about today are the way that light can also modify DNA and change the sequence of the DNA. And I hope that this long-winded introduction showed you that, you know, changing even a base can have dramatic consequences for life or for our life as we know it. I'm going to talk about both ultraviolet light and ionizing radiation. Right? So if we go back to our cartoon structure of DNA, ultraviolet light can be absorbed by DNA. And what can happen is if we have two thymine base pairs next to each other, and it absorbs a photon of ultraviolet light, we can actually create covalent bonds between these two base pairs. So it's called a thymine dimer. And that tends to distort the double helix of the DNA. It creates a kink in it, which then has all sorts of consequences for being able to decode it, to replicate it. So this is an error that needs to be changed. So hopefully this slide shows you that you should be wearing sunscreen to prevent the thymine dimers. But the reason I wanted to highlight the thymine dimers is because there's actually a really, really elegant mechanism that our bodies use to reverse this. And there's this enzyme called photolyase, which actually requires light from the sun to activate the repair process. So I just thought it was a very nice example of how light can damage DNA by creating, again, the cyclobutane between the two thymine molecules that neighbor each other. But then light is also required to activate the FADH cofactor, which ultimately is responsible for repairing this DNA damage. Now, again, I said I was going to be a little more liberal in my discussion of light. And if we think about stuff beyond visible light or beyond ultraviolet light, ionizing radiation can be quite damaging to DNA. And, you know, this isn't kind of a one-off, right? There's lots of sources of ionizing radiation in our everyday life. This includes, you know, X-rays, or going through those of you who flew here, right, going through the different metal detectors, or being in the atmosphere for a couple hours. It actually exposes you to a significant amount of radiation, which does all sorts of things to our DNA, right? So we've already talked about some of the different adducts, including the thymine dimer, but what happens when we break the backbone of DNA, so this the black part, all right? So if we think about DNA as a ladder, right, changing the bases is kind of like changing the steps of DNA. But what happens if we cut the side of the ladder, either on one side or both sides? Well, if you think of the ladder analogy, that tends to be a lot worse, right? I can kind of skip over a broken step on a ladder. But if you cut one or both of the supports, things are going to get kind of ugly there. Now, single-stranded breaks, where we break one strand of the backbone here, it's not great, but it's the repair process is at least more intuitive, it's more evident. Why? Because we have the template strand, right? We have the other strand that tells us what sequence is supposed to be there. So the fidelity of repairing this is actually relatively high. But what happens when we get double strand breaks? And this is something that ionizing radiation tends to do, is be able to break both strands of the DNA. Well, then we have a problem, right? Because we don't have a template strand anymore. And this can lead to fixed changes in the DNA. So we have different ways to repair it. One is non-homologous end joining, where we basically find two ends and we stick them together. And that's great if you grab the right two ends. And if you grab different ends, that can create major changes in chromosomal structure. The other example is, at least for sexually reproducing organisms like ourselves, right, we have homologous recombination. So we have chromosome from mom, chromosome from dad, and they're supposed to more or less encode the same genes. So what actually happens in homologous recombination, so let's say that dad's DNA is the one with the double strand break, shown here in blue, the cell is able to go through and basically find the equivalent gene on mom's DNA and use that as the template to generate the repair. And that works pretty good, except if mom's DNA is a little bit different from dad's DNA, well, now, instead of having one copy of the gene from mom, one copy from dad, at this particular location, you're going to have both copies from mom. So that's going to generate a change in our DNA. You know, and it could have an advantage in the environment, it could be neutral, it could be defective in the environment. And again, my goal here was more so just to highlight how light can play a role in damaging DNA, generating genetic diversity, but also, you know, in at least the example of photolyase, is, you know, being able to repair it as well. Again, I'm not going to have a strong thesis or conclusion other than just showing some of the different mechanisms by which it can work here. So in the last part of my talk, and this is going to be the shortest part of my presentation, I'm going to talk about some different fun examples of some of the different molecules that interact or are able to generate light in biology. And again, as an experimental biologist, just talk about how I would use this in terms of a research tool. So with this, one of the fun examples, and I think most well-known, is going to be fluorescence, right? So the idea, and physicists, again, be gentle here, right? The idea is that we have a photon coming in and excites an electron up to a higher energy state. We have this vibrational relaxation down to a slightly lower energy, but still excited state. And then when we get the full relaxation, we're going to emit a photon, but because of this vibrational relaxation here, right, it's going to be at a longer wavelength or a lower energy than the incoming photon. And this happens a lot in biology, and it was, the classic example is the jellyfish, Aquaria victoria, and we're actually able to identify and isolate the protein that is able to produce or, you know, be excited and undergo fluorescence here. And it's called green fluorescent protein because it's green light. And this was revolutionary in biology, right? So this won the Nobel Prize in 2008. But what's so exciting about having, you know, a protein that is able to fluoresce? Well, it's an immensely powerful research tool. And this thing has probably been in vitro evolved and mutated to death, but we've created entire color palettes of fluorescent proteins. So any color under the rainbow, different quantum yields, half-lives, you know, just huge, huge, you know, diversity. There's actually an entire online database called Fluorescent Protein Base, or FP Base, where you can go through and find all the different, hundreds of different proteins that are fluorescent. But so this is cool, it makes a nice picture. What does it actually do? Well, the power of this is it's genetically encodable, right? So if I want to see something under a microscope, yeah, I can buy a chemically fluorescent dye, but if I want to get it into the cell, I have to make a hole in the cell to get it in, which generally isn't compatible with life. So what if I actually have a Trojan horse? What if I put it in and put the DNA that encodes GFP into the cell, and I can fuse it to any protein I want? And there are entire catalogs, like we have, you know, in the model system yeast, we have, you know, the entire genome tagged with GFP at either the N-terminus or the C-terminus, right? So incredibly powerful. And if you do it right, it shouldn't interfere with the function of your protein. So you get something like this, your functional protein with GFP kind of hanging off in space, not bothering it. But what does it do? It allows us to do live cell microscopy. So we can actually do stuff like this where we can visualize the process of cell division, right? So this is one cell undergoing cytokinesis or mitosis more generally, condensing the chromosomes. You're actually pulling it apart as you're generating two cells. And we can see this process taking place in a living cell because we were able to clone GFP from a jellyfish and put it onto the right proteins in our cell. So another example of light is instead of absorbing light from the environment, there are ways to actually generate light. And I think we're very familiar with this from fireflies, right? There's not a whole lot of light at night. Fireflies don't have a capacitor in their tail to be able to absorb and then release all that light. So how does this actually work? And I guess, fittingly, the enzyme is called luciferase because it generates its own light rather than taking light from the environment. But it can actually use the molecule I introduced at the beginning, ATP, as a source of energy and the substrate luciferin, and it generates oxyluciferin, and it also generates light in the process. Now, this is an enzyme that we actually use all the time in my lab, and it's really powerful compared to GFP because you don't need to excite it. You don't need a light source, which means we have way, way better signal to noise when using this. Why? Because it can be completely dark, and then if we see the generation of any light, then it's really easy to observe very faint or very weak signals. I think I have two examples left. They're both very quick. Another example is this concept of phototropism, right? I think we've seen this especially with houseplants, right? If you put a plant by a window, it's going to bend towards the light. How does it actually sense that? Well, we are actually able to see or identify the proteins that do this. So one of them is called the love domain. And what happens here is there's this J-alpha helix. And when it's excited, the love domain is excited with blue light. This FMN cofactor forms a covalent bond with the cysteine side chain of the love protein. And that causes the J-alpha helix to become unfolded and kind of start floating out into space, be highly flexible, be able to then go and do something. Now, as an experimentalist, this is actually incredibly powerful because it allows me to make a change in the cell almost instantaneously without having to put anything in. I just shine light on it. This is really gets into the field of optogenetics, and people have really used the love domain to engineer a bunch of proteins. And one example here that's kind of related to my thesis work, you can have a degradation tag called the SSRA tag on your protein, and it's blocked, right? It's not visible to anything in the cell. You shine light, the J-alpha helix becomes unfolded, the degradation tag, or the eat me signal, is then exposed, and you can get rid of this protein very, very rapidly in the cell, and get rid of only that protein, and create a major change in the cell almost instantaneously. And another example, another common tool used in biology or in optogenetics is this protein called the Cry2 protein. What happens here is you shine light on it, and then it's able to oligomerize, right? Instead of having just one copy by itself, you end up having four of them come together. And one example of this comes from my colleague, Chris Donnelly. And he's studying the protein TDP43, which tends to aggregate a lot in Lou Gehrig's disease, right, ALS. And the hallmark of this is you have this mess of proteins, this aggregate of proteins. But to study it in a cell is really hard, right? How do you control the kinetics? How do you induce this? Well, you put the Cry2 domain on a TDP43. And put the Cry2 domain on it, shine light, all of a sudden, you get puncta, right? You are able to replicate these aggregates of the protein in a cell and basically be able to induce what we think is the pathogenic effect very, very quickly and be able to study what's happening at the molecular level using the Cry2 domain here and just using light, only affecting the protein that you care about because nothing else in a human cell is going to have the Cry2 domain in it. So that's what I have today. Again, it was kind of a grab bag at the end, but just to kind of try to tie this all together in a package, right? We know a lot of the molecules within living organisms that respond to light, and we can really more or less rationalize what's happening, right? Chlorophyll's doing this, photolysis is doing this. GFP is, you know, there to startle predators, and, you know, luciferase is there for fireflies. And I hope I showed you that it's a powerful tool in modern biological research. I started the presentation by showing you about photosynthesis, but really thinking about it in a more abstract way in terms of energy capture, and then using kind of the counterexample of chemolithotropes. And then I showed you in the middle about how light can be a source of biological change and genetic diversity. So in conclusion, I hope this presentation taught you a little bit about love. It didn't make you cry too much, and it reminded you to wear your sunscreen. So with that, I'd like to say thank you. And I showed some data, so I want to acknowledge my lab and funding sources here. So thank you.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.